Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's the season, a time when I think most of us feel a little more generous toward our fellow human beings, and there are people bent on doing us some harm and taking the money from us that maybe we'd like to be giving to somebody else, somebody who really deserves it. There are scammers out there that are trying to exploit our shopping activity, among other things, and we need to be careful about that. And that's why we have our folks from the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection with us to talk about how you can avoid that. Michelle Reinen is administrator in the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Michelle, good to see you.
Thanks, Larry. It's nice to be here.
And Michael Domke is director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. Michael, good to have you back as well.
Great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
As we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in today. I want to hear from you. Have you been scammed, or you have an experience to share, maybe a question to ask? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michelle, let's start with you. You know, here's the season. It's time to celebrate good cheer and so forth, but it's also ripe with opportunity for thieves.
It sure is. I mean, we talk about this year-round because they're always trying to interfere with our daily transactions. But this time of year, they know we're busy. Hustle and bustle of the season to get ready. We're trying to do year-end wrap-up at our jobs, and we have the holidays coming, more family and everything. So there's more opportunity to just catch us off guard. And in addition, we're online, likely, doing a lot of shopping, trying to save time. And we have data that actually talks about online shopping and how many consumers have filed complaints about online shopping frauds and scams. I mean, in 2024, consumers made over 380,000 complaints nationally. 5,000 of those reports came from Wisconsin consumers, making online shopping one of the top fraud categories. And it's because those scammers are out there trying to take advantage of us, creating fake websites, creating advertisements, trying to pull us into those fake websites, make those purchases, hand over our personal information, and put us at risk of identity theft as well.
Yeah. So what kinds of things should we be looking for or maybe avoid buying from, let's say, let's go to individual online sellers? Because you see a lot of that to begin with.
Yeah, the online marketplace type situations, those third-party vendors. There, we need to be cautious and avoid paying up front. We want to be sure that what we're getting, because usually it's something unique. It's a one-of-a-kind something that an individual has and is selling. They are not a retail business. They're using a third-party marketplace, often trying to exchange their goods. It could be the online classified ad or that online peer-to-peer marketplace. So you don't want to pay up front for anything sold on these platforms because you don't know if you'll get it. So using an escrow service to hold the funds before you get the product, or using a reputable third-party platform that has guarantees about the sellers and you receiving product, otherwise they'll stand behind it. That's going to be important. Also, making sure whatever communication you have with the seller stays on the platform. Let moving off the platform be a red flag to you that you could be dealing with a scammer, because now there's not going to be that record of the communication that you have and what they've been representing to you. And then the type of payment that they want you to make. It should be something like a credit card, because you can have the extra protections federally to dispute the charges. Using that escrow service in order to secure your funds versus, why don't you wire me some money, or why don't you use a peer-to-peer payment app to send the money, or cryptocurrency to send the money? Because those things aren't going to be traceable, and the money will be received by the seller, which we're talking about being the scammer, and then they're gone. versus something that is regulated and trackable.
I was thinking, you know, this is the time of the year, too, when you have Pat Says Gifts come up, you know, that new puppy or that new kitten. Are there scams that relate to that?
There absolutely are scams that relate to pets as gifts. This is a time of year when a lot of households want the cute little puppy with the bow underneath the holiday tree, and they're going to try and give that during this holiday season. And we want people to practice caution here as well, because scammers post that they have a particular pet available, have the picture. You fall in love with that pet. You reach out and say, yeah, I'm the one for this this animal and want to bring it into the household. But they no longer have it available. It's found its new home. But here's an alternative. I've seen this. So they hook you up with a scammer, if you will. It's part of their ploy that they have. And it's an associated pet, if you will, and it's for sale. You may see claims for purebred puppies or other rare animals that can be hard to obtain and could be in demand. But they will, once you lay claim, if you will, that you want to reach out and get this pet, they'll come up with all sorts of reasons as to why it costs more. You need to pay for a veterinary check, or we need to transport it in a particular crate. There are shipping costs, delivery fees that will add up. And so they'll keep coming back to you with more and more money, and yet you'll never get the pet because the pet never truly exists.
And I'm expecting it by that as well, they're getting a lot of personal information. So you're winding up with potential for identity theft.
They could, in a pet scam, ask for personally identifiable information or any one of these online shopping situations. You can always be vulnerable to identity theft because they can create a reason as to why they need to ask for this personal information. One thing we see during the holiday season and in other kinds of big national and international events are fun games that can be online.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to say, if people probably heard me, you know, the family gets together and, oh, look at this, let's pick our fun reindeer names, you know, and you put in information into this website where they're asking you all these survey questions that seem innocent enough, just to create your favorite family reindeer name, but really it's a data bank pulling information out about you. And maybe it was the name of your first pet. Well, the name of your first pet is often a security question. And so you don't think of it the same as a social security number. You know you need to keep that confidential. But why are you freely handing out all this information about yourself to some website or app that you know nothing about and who's controlling it and how they're compiling all that data?
Yeah. Michael, there's also, I don't know about you, but I'm inundated with emails, text messages, lots of text messages lately, and social media messages. They're offering products and services, and especially this time of the year, it seems like. In other words, there can be phishing scams in this. How do you tell if you've got a legitimate business that you're working with?
That's going to be very difficult. These scammers have gotten so good at making the text messages, the emails, so convincing because the imagery matches exactly what the legitimate retailer looks like. We don't see those misspellings or the poor grammars much anymore, so everything seems to be legitimate. The challenge there is just making sure that you don't respond to those messages. And unfortunately, even if you are making some purchases from online retailers or using a shipping service and are expecting them, we still want everyone to be vigilant and not respond to those text messages. Don't call the phone numbers. Don't click on those links. A lot of them will have track your package. Instead, we really want to redirect everyone to where they made that purchase, to that legitimate retailer. If they have an opportunity, use the app on your phone. That's a really safe way to find out if something has gone wrong. Or going directly to those shipping sites and finding out, is there truly an issue with your package being delivered? A lot of the time we're going to see over the next month is going to be those shipping text messages and scams. We'll see other types of phishing from retailers promoting a particular product. But by and large, we're going to see that explosion of shipping issues.
Well, yeah, and I can imagine that because you're ordering a lot of things online, you may be, and then if you get a message like that, you relate that to what the actual transaction you made.
100%, because a lot of us, as Michelle mentioned, are making purchases online, which means they have to be shipped to us. But also during this holiday season, it's very likely that some of us will be expecting a package as well. And so these scammers, really, they can hedge their bets, and this is the prime time to do it because of so many people will either be shipping or receiving a package. And so the likelihood of them hitting someone who really may click on that link because it does match up with something they've done is pretty high.
Yeah. Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, our guests today from the DATCAP Bureau of Consumer Protection. Questions or an experience to share? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at consumer scams during this holiday season. Actually, they happen all year round, but it seems like worse at this time of the year. Is it, by the way, is it the worst time of the year for that, Michelle? Or?
For these types of scams that we're talking about, yeah. Absolutely. But we see spikes throughout the year where there's an event. And so if you remember, pretty much everyone in the state of Wisconsin in March on the same day at the same moment in time received the fake toll text message.
Yeah,
you could be in a room.
I got that.
And everyone's phone was going off. So we see these significant spikes where something is circulating. But for online shopping, because we're all focused on it, there's all the websites. And we're all trying to get the same hot purchased item. And so we're targeted at this time of year, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Jim in Stevens Point has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I have a question about Facebook. I purchased an item on Facebook, and unfortunately, it never came. It wasn't a lot of money, so that was okay. But my question is, should you just not buy off of any kind of Facebook ad? Is that not a good place to be doing any purchasing?
It certainly is a third-party online marketplace where you don't have the same protections as a normal retailer that is designed just for their own goods, because these are a random individual promoting their goods. So checking it out and being able to follow puts you at a higher risk or more vulnerability. If you're going to do that shopping, there's a lot of steps you need to take in order to validate the information and feel confident about the purchase to protect yourself to be sure you're going to get something. And if you're not going to take those steps, then hopefully you can find an alternative place.
Yeah, so the steps are?
The steps are that you really need to do your research. Take a look at the description of the product to see if you think it's legitimate or not. You have to research the seller, and that means looking at the reviews that other people have engaged with. Understand what protections the platform may have for you against a seller if you don't receive the product. Making sure you're using the right payment method, so maybe you have some protection there, and that's going to be a credit card or whatever payment method the platform has. So again, you could have a potential dispute. And when you don't get this product, you know, Jim, filing that with Facebook and reporting it so they can try and remove that seller if they continue to try and sell goods, so you can protect others as well.
And Michael, you wanted to add.
If I could just add one thing too, Jim, is making sure and all the listeners that you're not putting all of your trust in that user profile, that is that person. You know, Michelle mentioned that making sure if it is somebody you think you know, maybe reach out to them through a secondary source, because Facebook takeover accounts are the number one identity theft complaint that we receive. And so during this time of year, these scammers are going to create these profiles or get into these trusted groups. And so, Larry, you and I might be friends and you may be selling something. And so I think, well, it's Larry. I trust him. And so I'm going to send you that money. But unbeknownst to me, it's not really you. It's the scammer. And so we want everyone to just take a little bit of a step, be cautionary, and not just trust that profile is the person you think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that leads to another great point. You know, we could do a whole show on just this, and that is that you may see your retailer that you always go to. It's your trusted source promoting a great sale for the holidays on Facebook through their account, and you want to click that link to go there. However, what Michael just mentioned about those profiles being taken over, those account takeovers, is that you don't want to click that link. You want to go to that trusted retailer using the regular login method you would use on a daily basis, so that way you don't end up at that imposter site for that business, and then you're also dealing with a scammer. So, yeah, it seems complicated, but it's feeling you got to trust your gut sometimes, too. Yeah. You just have to trust your gut.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Rena in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hey, hi. I have a question about the text messages. I get a lot of them saying that my package, there's a problem delivering my package. And I go and check the actual delivery site, and I find there isn't. Now, but what can I do with that text message? Can I somehow report it or get it to stop? Or something so that at least I can make a little dent in that traffic.
Yeah. Michael, what have you got for Rena here?
Rena, you absolutely can report those, and you report them to us at the Bureau of Consumer Protection. You can either do that online at datcp.wi.gov, or you can even call us at 1-800-422-7128. And our hotline will take that information from you. And then what we do is if we start seeing a pattern of the same phone numbers, it gives us an opportunity to dig a little deeper and see who might be behind that and hopefully put a dent in stopping them.
And what's the address again? The email address is?
Our website is datcp.wi.gov.
And the number 800-422-7128, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Rena, there you go. Thank you. Angela in Appleton, what's on your mind?
I guess this is kind of timely for this time of the year when people might be getting going to parties and stuff. I got an invitation. It was a brunch invitation email. And it looked like it was authentic, so I clicked on the button, and then it asked for my email account name, ID, and password, which I entered. And it didn't work, so then I entered my Gmail account, and it didn't work. Well, what I found out was that I got this email from somebody in a class that I take, and his email also got infected. So I'm wondering if you've heard of that. And should I be changing the passwords on my email accounts? And do you know what damage it may have done to my email? Because what I also found out was that I'm not receiving emails from some businesses. They sent me an invoice, and I didn't receive it from them, and I didn't receive an email from somebody else. So I'm wondering what damage it may have done to my email account.
Okay. Well, Michael, do you want to take a crack at that?
I don't know exactly what may have happened, Angela, but I can give you a couple ideas on hopefully you can protect yourself from further harm. The first is I would definitely change your passwords, because if you entered your login and a password, and many of us will use the same passwords for different accounts, if that information is out there and they realize where you might else be using that email address or login, that might also get compromised. So you want to change that quickly. And then also, if you aren't receiving any more emails, or it's possible that that whole entire email account was compromised and that email is being forwarded someplace else, which is why you might not receive them. So I would take a close look, depending on how long you have that or how widespread that email address is. You may want to think about getting a different one. One thing that Angela brought to light is using that login and password to some place that has worked before or may be normal and all of a sudden it doesn't work, that's a red flag that everyone really wants to think about and say, is it me just forgetting my password, or is it possibly that this has been compromised or I'm not on the right site? You know, Michelle was talking earlier about these fictitious retailers, and if you're going to a regular retailer that you know this is your login, you know this is your password, but it just doesn't work, that's a red flag that you should pause and say, I might not be on the right website. Same with this email, same with these links that you click on.
Yeah, makes good sense. Does that help, Angela?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling. And let's go to Susan in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Hi, Susan.
So I have been looking at programs, how to remove duplicate copies of my pictures and screenshots from my PC. How do I know when I choose one of these programs that it's legitimate?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I think really doing a lot of research, which you are looking at a lot of alternatives, and then turning to probably some tech support, talking to individuals at a tech support store or the magazines that are available. I'm sure listening to Larry's show when he has the computer guys on and calling in and asking them what things you can do to evaluate that you really are using a good quality product to do these searches. But you're not going to want to respond to something that just pops up as a result of your searches, because certainly our devices are trying to feed us things. Know that what returns in the sponsor or higher up in the return values can be paid or scammers, because they use those tactics to have their information as higher returns and scrolling down. But you're really going to want to do a lot of research in checking them out. You could probably call Consumer Protection to see if we've had any complaints against that company, as well as the Better Business Bureaus. And then looking at consumer reviews as well. And not just looking for the star rating, but reading those reviews and concentrating on the negative ones. What are they telling you?
Yeah, all good advice. Susan, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mark in Maquantico emailed to say they know they have a certain amount of protection when using a credit card to pay for a purchase. Do you have the same protection if you use a debit card? Michael?
The answer is no. And so I would use this as an opportunity to really emphasize, if you have the opportunity to use a credit card, please always do so. The big reason for that is the amount of time that you have to file a dispute is very different. So in using a debit card, oftentimes you only have 48 hours to file the dispute if something goes wrong, whereas with a credit card, you have at least 60 days to do so. And that's important because if something does not work out with that transaction, we usually don't know it right away. If that product doesn't show up or that product isn't what you ordered, it's oftentimes going to be well past that 48 hours. And so after that 48 hours, it limits what your ability is to recover from what your loss is when you use a debit card. With a credit card, you have a much longer time. Also, those credit cards have very robust fraud teams, and they have indicators, and they have systems in place to let you know when something went wrong. And so we might be annoying if all of a sudden it gets frozen, you get that phone call, but that's good. It's to your benefit. And so that's additional protections using that credit card will give you when making those. I would always encourage that.
Yeah, I was just thinking, not long ago I bought something, and it was different from what I normally would purchase. Because I was purchasing for a friend, and I almost instantly got something from the credit card company saying, did you really do this?
Yeah, right. I had a family member during the holidays a few years back that was trying to get a particular gift and had bought it from a website, and it didn't come. So I had said, look, you need to file the dispute, call the credit card company. They didn't make that family member go through the paperwork process at all. They'd had so many complaints from other consumers. They'd already shut it down.
Wow.
That they were no longer allowing transactions to that company through your card. So they were rejecting it. And then they were just going through anyone who called and just refunding the money because they were capturing it back.
And even earlier this week, I decided in one day to do a lot of the shopping. And I've got an alert saying, hey, this type of volume isn't typical for you. Are you really making this many purchases?
You know, the day before, get it done.
But it feels good to know that you've got, you know, at least with some cards,
right,
that you've got that protection or that help. And, of course, they're interested in not having you get scammed and not having to return money and all this and that if they can help it. So,
absolutely.
Jane and Oconomowoc, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for answering. Hey, on the 2nd of December, I got this email, and I don't use email a lot. I don't ever really use Facebook, but I did join it many, many years ago, but I'm not on it anymore. So I, on a second, I got this, and it says, did you log in near Cedar Hill on a new device? This is Facebook security at facebookmail.com to Jane Seeley Sr. That was my silly name. But it says, then it shows me a map, and it says, someone just logged into your Facebook account near Cedar Hill, Montana, United States, on something. Take some simple steps to secure your account. And then it says, Cedar Hill, Montana, United States, Chrome on Micro Max A56. A56 is my phone type, I guess.
Yeah.
And then that was at 10:34 last night, or the second.
Hmm.
So what I would do with that is, I assume there's a link with that to, you know, click this to go secure. That may be a true alert, but it may also just be a random thing to obtain your login information for your account. So go log in to Facebook normally and change your password and PIN information, or see if there's been activity. Let that be an alert to you, but not what you click and use to get there. Is always our practice and messaging there, because you can never be 100% certain that that's actually a legitimate flag coming, because you've never seen it before for the history that you've had that account, and you need to be cautious with those links.
Yeah,
and I will say that's not a unique scam that we haven't seen this across other platforms. We'll see it being used against Apple. We see it used against Microsoft. We see it used against Google, where it says this account is logged in at XYZ, and they'll have some fictitious location and device number or so on. And it's just getting you to respond to it, because it creates that panic that, oh, who's in my account? And then you click on the link without realizing what you're doing, and of course it's a scammer.
And if you've got an icon, the Facebook icon, for example, that's and you use that, you know that icon is correct, then you can click on that icon to get to, that's an easy way.
It is. Yep. That is something we always advocate. If you have the opportunity to use an app over typing at a website or going to a website or clicking a link, always go to your app. There are more security features within that app and provides you that peace of mind that you're at the right spot.
Yeah. Jane, thank you and good luck. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk at WPR.org. We've had some really great calls and emails this morning already, and we got open lines to get you on pretty quickly, and we've got some emails to deal with as well. Christine emailed to ask about purchasing online protection services such as Guardio. What do you think about these monthly subscription services, Michelle? Or Michael, you want to take it?
Yeah, it really depends on what the service offers, but oftentimes we see these services will provide things that a consumer can do for free by themselves. And so we're not in a position to say whether they're good or bad or right or wrong. It's really getting into the details of exactly what they're going to offer, comparing that against what you could potentially do by yourself on your own, sometimes for free, and then really making the call on whether you want to subscribe to having them do it for you. Sometimes I like to talk about lawn care. We have the ability to go out and mow the lawn ourselves, or sometimes we could pay a landscaper to do it for us. Some of these services provide that same thing. It's sometimes just convenience. They aren't always being able to look at things that you can't find yourself. And so it's more of a question of, do I want to pay for a service and have them do it for me, versus are they really able to provide something you can't do?
Yeah, makes sense. So depending on the service, you can look up, think about it yourself. Well, how hard is it going to be?
Right. And a lot of these times with the identity, it's what they're doing is monitoring kind of your credit report, seeing who's you can do that for free. They're looking at what type of transactions might have taken place. You can oftentimes do that yourself by using, the apps mm-hmm. for the accounts that you're tied to. So they're just kind of aggregating all of that for you. But we can usually do it on our own.
And you're going to have to turn over your information to that company in order for them to do that job. So you have to vet that company as well. Have they had any complaints or actions against them for data storage or privacy protection of information? What's their data breach and security? If you discontinue doing business with them, how will they discard your information, or how long will they retain it? Because In order for them to do the job you're asking them to, you have to be confident in handing over your information.
I was hoping if I could find a segue, and Michelle just gave it to me when she said data breach, was Mark had mentioned earlier about credit card versus debit card, and I really want to emphasize one additional feature there is if you use your debit card, maybe you create an account or use it to make a purchase, and down the road, unfortunately, that company becomes compromised and they suffer a data breach, the risk of your debit card being compromised versus your credit card is much higher. Because now all of your actual liquid funds are at risk versus a credit card, you're not really going to lose anything. And so it's the key of, again, we talked about holidays in the beginning, giving your information at sweepstakes, giving information for these services, using that, being cognizant of what you're giving away and do you really need to do so.
Kay emailed us to say they always look at the email detail from a sender that might be a scam, be it PayPal or Amex, Chase or other financial companies they use, the email looks real, but when Kay sees the sender's email address, they know it's a scam. Just double click on the sender to see the email detail. And for any text request for money, I text stop as a reply. Kay also uses politicians' websites for making any political contributions.
Great practices. It's hard on a smart device unless you take the extra time and steps to identify that true email address, because you have to do a couple clicks often because of how it presents itself on different devices. And so it is a great practice to look at where it's coming from. But I will say that scammers have become very talented in masking that. So you really have to take time and caution in looking at that, because through their technology and their skill set, they are trying to definitely misrepresent where something's coming from. So you could think it's coming from a legitimate company and resource, but it could really just be from that scammer as well. So let that be one of the steps that you take to do that verification and feel confident with it.
Thinking about credit cards, I'll tell one on myself. Maybe I've mentioned this on the air before, but I once from a relative gave me it was actually a gift card from a chain, a restaurant chain, and it was for $100. And he said, "I've had this a long time. I'm not going to use it. Do you want to take it?" So I took it, took somebody for dinner, and I handed him the gift card. And the amount was close to $100, to be perfectly honest. And I got back, she brought the gift back, and it was like only $2.89 had been taken off the, and I owed the rest myself.
It had been drained?
Yeah. And she said, "Well, this happens with our gift cards. We start taking off an amount of money after a certain time."
Oh, in activity fees.
In activity fees, and it had gone down to the. So I have never gone to that chain restaurant again, and I won't say what it was, who it was, because it was a long time ago. But that's one way that gift cards can be a problem, but there are a lot of ways that there can be gift card scams, can't there?
Absolutely. And you're talking about holding onto a gift card for way too long in activity fees, and I am guilty of that as well. You put them in the pile, you swear you're going to use them. But the other thing is that gift cards can get drained on you by scammers. So that is something when you are purchasing a gift card, you really have to physically examine it to be sure that it hasn't been tampered with in any way, because there are fraud rings out there taking down the gift card transaction numbers or the SKU numbers on that and trying to obtain the PIN numbers as well in some cases.
Oh.
And then as soon as you load it, they're out there searching to see if they're loaded, and they turn around and drain them into their own accounts. And actually, federally, there is a task force now that's been developed with Homeland Security in relation to this, because it is such a huge amount of money being lost by consumers that they've started this task force federally. So it's really important, if you identify that this has happened to you, that you report it to the retailer right away so they can take their actions, if at all, in trying to stop and reverse that money from being used or track it as well. But This is also why you have to be cautious about buying gift cards online through third-party marketplaces. If you're buying it directly from the retailer online and getting an electronic gift card, buy it as close to your giving it to the recipient and make sure they get it loaded onto any account that they have with the company. So that way the gift card itself is drained, but it's in that person's account with the company to be used if they have one. I mean, that's one workaround for that, certainly.
It is, and that's a common scam we're going to see around the holidays, especially in January, where you're going to see on those third-party marketplaces individuals saying, oh, I got this gift card for X retailer, and I never go there, so I'll sell it to this $100 gift card for $50. And in reality, you can't really prove. They'd have to provide all the information, which they're not going to do, to sort that out. The other thing we'll mention to kind of follow through with, Michelle was talking about when you're making these gift card purchases, all these things you need to make sure. Also, if you're the recipient of one, because of all the reasons Michelle just laid out, use it quickly. Not just because of those convenience fees, but the longer you hold on to that, the longer there's that risk that may potentially get drained.
We also see, unfortunately, some companies after the new year, if the holidays weren't good to them, they also may close their doors, and then that gift card isn't going to have any value either. We just see that as a reality some seasons. So be mindful of using them and supporting those businesses.
Well, when I was at that restaurant and getting out my credit card to cover the $97 and whatever that wasn't part of the gift card, I thought, well, this is a lesson well learned. And it only cost, well, only 97. Who wants to lose $97? And I did get a dinner out of it and all that, or a couple of dinners out of it. But it's a lesson, and a lot of people are losing a whole lot more money than $97. That's for sure. Yeah. Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, our guests today from the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection for our Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection. I got some more emails to go through here, but we have room for you if you want to call in. And I hope you do. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. In any case, we'll get you on pretty quickly with your own experience or maybe your own question. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick mention, a little bit later on, we're going to, at the bottom of the hour, as a matter of fact, we'll be hearing from Patricia Skalka. She has a new book out. It's titled Star Song, a novella, and it's a lovely lovely book, and we'll be talking with her about that. But right now, we're taking a look at consumer scams with Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke. And I hope you'll join in. We can give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. The number's 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Roberta emailed to say they received a letter from a Canadian law firm about an unclaimed inheritance from a woman who shares Roberta's last name, and Roberta assumed it was some sort of scam. Could a scammer be using as a front a legitimate law firm but an email address that goes elsewhere?
The answer is yes, but they aren't really using that law firm. They're just posing as that law firm. We've received complaints of this exact same scam. Where what they're doing is they're finding consumer information and then they're creating a tie to that lineage and saying here. And sometimes they even get lucky and get the actual ancestor's name right and send that letter out. But what they're doing is encouraging them to potentially follow up and look. And they'll use legitimate law firm names so that when you go on and research and it says, oh, that is true. But they don't take that second step and actually reach out to that law firm. They usually respond to the information on the letter, whether that be a phone number or email address. But if you do receive one of these, unfortunately, you're not going to receive that inheritance because they're all scams.
Ugh. Well, that's sad to hear. Jake in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jake.
Hello. I have a retirement account from probably 10 years ago that was just contributed to for about a year or two, and it was sold several times, Now it's a company called Inspire. And I noticed the fees for service are basically just going to delete the entire account after a while. And I cannot get a hold of the company at all. They don't answer their phone. They don't answer emails. And I want some advice.
I think this might be a time to get a hold of ADCAP, Division of Consumer Protection.
Yes, absolutely. We may have to refer to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the federal level, but we can try and help identify that contact information and try and open up that line of communication there, because you should be able to try and take actions with your retirement account and enroll that into something else that would not just get used up on you. I've certainly heard of that situation before. So you can file that complaint directly on our website if you'd like at datcp.wi.gov or call 800-422-7128 and have a complaint form sent out to you or emailed to you.
Yeah. 800-422-7128 or go to datcp.wi.gov. There you go.
I would also say if he has a different financial advisor in some way, they should also be able to help make that contact with that retirement account to take action with that. That would be another alternative.
Mm-hmm. Peter in Eden emailed to say that for about 6 months they've been getting daily calls, two or three a day. The calls come from different numbers, states, and addresses asking if Peter wants to have his tax resolution resolved. He didn't sign up for such a service. The messages go to voicemail before Peter can answer the phone. Wants to know if he needs to call back and tell them they are not interested. He doesn't have any tax problems.
I would discourage Peter from responding to any of those and having that conversation. Oftentimes what that'll do is just encourage that particular scammer individual to keep calling or call that number with a different type of scam because they know that somebody might respond to it. So just ignore them. But then also, you can report those phone numbers to us at DATCAP at the phone number and email provided and give us an opportunity to kind of see if we're getting that phone number from others or look at see who is behind it.
Makes good sense. Thank you very much for that question. And again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. I have various places that I give money to, charities, every year. It's sad to imagine there's unscrupulous people around running charity scams. But how do we make our donations go to the causes and organizations we want to support, Michelle?
First, kind of our theme of the day, you're going to need to do research before donating. You want to take the time to learn about the organization and verify that it is legitimate before giving. You can do that by asking for details, especially if you receive a solicitation or an email. It should have details about the organization, the name, the address, the phone number, how much of your donation will be used for the charitable purpose and other costs. And they should want to brag about the success stories that they've had during the last year and provide an annual report that highlights those success stories and the actions that they've taken. Red flags that who you'd be interacting with would be someone who is an organization that's demanding and giving you very high pressure and demands immediate payment or demands payment by cryptocurrency, banking apps, gift cards, wire transfer, something that is not reversible and not trackable. So you want to usually make your donations either in a check written directly to the organization or using a credit card. Maybe there's a time when you're in person that you're giving cash directly to that organization and you can see that it's going into their collection fund. But you need to avoid high pressure. And I want to lend caution to that. Understand the difference between high pressure and immediate demands versus high energy campaigns. there are very high energy campaigns during this month because there are a lot of really great causes with end of year goals that they're trying to reach, but they're explaining to you exactly how they're going to impact your community and individuals in your community. And that, again, goes to those details that you can verify and see are legitimate. And I think the other safe way to donate is to create your list. You know who you want to donate to and reach out directly to make those donations, as opposed to clicking a link in one of the emails that they may send to you. So there isn't any risk of you confusing a legitimate, double your donation email energy versus the scammer that's impersonating that same well-known organization. Mm-hmm. And that usually happens at the national level with those very popular, well-known campaigns.
Nancy in Waukesha, what's on your mind? Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I have a school friend that I'd like to give $100 for
Christmas. Oh, and you're breaking up, Nancy, but I think I've got the gist here of your question on the screen. Nancy likes to give gift cards for Christmas, at least to some of the people on her list. And she's wondering, where should she purchase these gifts, these gift cards, Michael?
Depending on who she wants to buy for, but I would say just go to any of your legitimate, recognized local retailers and buy directly from them. And then when doing so, make sure you're inspecting that packaging closely. You're going to look at the back of the card and make sure that that PIN number isn't exposed, that it's still covered. You want to make sure, you know, on the back of the card where you have that silver covering, that there's no sticker over top of that, because sometimes that what these scammers will scratch that off, get the number, put another sticker over top. We're seeing some retailers lock them up in plastic boxes. If that's the case, you could tell that box hasn't been tampered with. You can pretty much be assured that that's a safe way to buy it. But it really comes down to going to reputable local places and then looking at the card and making sure it's legitimate. And then I would also, you know, use that tip after she gives it to just encourage them to use it right away, just so they don't lose it as well.
Yeah. And if you go directly to the store involved, if you go somewhere else to buy the card, let's say, you know, a grocery store might have, or a drugstore might have a whole host of, and, oh, okay, I don't have to run to Target or wherever, I can just get it here. But I did that once, and then I realized that they also charge you a fee for that.
Some of them will charge a fee for purchasing for somebody else's retailer. So if you have the opportunity to go direct, you're going to save a couple bucks there. But, of course, then the convenience of those other ones offering for everywhere is what you're paying for.
That's what you're paying for. Phyllis emailed to ask, say they had a credit card that was compromised and replaced. Does that mean Phyllis should also have her debit card replaced? So the credit card was compromised. It doesn't appear that I can read here that the debit card was compromised, but should she have that replaced?
It's so hard to know how the credit card was compromised from that information.
Oh,
you
sure.
know, it could have been that it was at from a chip, a reader, you know, a skimmer at a point of sale purchase, or it could be from a data breach. It's really impossible to know. It's great the credit card company caught it and took action. So monitor the activity on the debit card, limit the funds available on the card so it can't be withdrawn more. Or if she's that uncomfortable, talk to the bank about replacing the debit card so she can have more comfort in that.
So it is possible on a debit card to say, no more than $1,000 or no more than $500.
That's a safe
way to do things.
You can absolutely set limits with your bank. You cannot tie it to your savings account, so that way you don't have that risk of overdraw.
Yeah. Our guests today will be with us right up until 12:30 today, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Bureau of Consumer Protection within our Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. I hope you'll join in with your own experience or question. I'd love to hear from you. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look on the show today at how to identify scams before you fall for them. And here with us from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Michelle Reinand, Administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael Domke. Michael is Director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. So it's great to have both of them with us. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. Maybe we've got a story to tell. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Call will get you on pretty quickly. You can also email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Let's see, we got several emails. Let's take an email or two while we're waiting for some phone calls. Adam in Verona emailed to ask if DATCAP recommends freezing your credit at all three major credit agencies to prevent hackers and then unfreezing them when you need to. Michael?
The resounding answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. That is one of the best things that any of us can do to secure our identity and our credit. And what happens is you just can go online or you can call to all three credit reporting agencies. And what that freeze does is it prevents anyone from opening a new line of credit with your information. And that's really important because we hear about these new, whether it be loans or credit cards or things like that happening, and then it's very difficult to recover from those. And the security freeze prevents that. And then it's very easy. It's called thawing it out. It usually takes about a half an hour. And what, for an example, would be if you were out to purchase a vehicle and you would ask that dealership, which credit reporting agency do you use to run the credit to make the purchase or finance the car? And then you would just call that particular credit agency that they use. You would thaw it out. They go ahead and run it. You make that purchase, and then you put that freeze back on, and then you walk around protected. So we emphasize this in every presentation we give when we're talking about scams and identity theft because it's a great, great tool.
We have another email from Debbie in La Crosse. Many charity organizations, they give to them and they extensively vet them. But last week was the first time Debbie encountered a charity taking cryptocurrency. Debbie said they, like most of us, are leery of that. And that the whole area, Michael, of cryptocurrency is worth talking about.
It really is. And I would say if you have a charity that is asking for cryptocurrency, really, really pause and take caution before you give there. Because that is one of the telltale signs of when a scammer is either purporting to be a charity or has set one up themselves and is just using it as a money grab. So be very cautious when giving crypto. But to use that as a platform to really talk about something else we want to bring awareness to, and those are cryptocurrency kiosks. And many of us have probably seen one of these already and just didn't realize it. And they look just like the ATMs that you see in convenience stores, grocery stores. But they have a little symbol next to them. They usually have a Bitcoin or Ethereum. But what these cryptocurrency kiosks are is you have the ability to put cash into it, and then it will purchase cryptocurrency for you and send that oftentimes into a wallet. And I don't want to get too deep into what that is, but it's the ability to buy cryptocurrency. Unfortunately, this has become a real, real hotspot for scammers, and it's kind of the evolution of when we've seen payment methods. It was wiring, then it went to gift cards, and now we're at cryptocurrency. And with these kiosks, unfortunately, they're being used by scammers to convince their victims to take cash and put them into what they're calling as government lockers or safety lockers or security kiosks and things like that. But unfortunately, they're really just being used to, unfortunately, facilitate fraud and scams. And I don't like to always throw out data, but I think it's very compelling to drive home the point here. The Attorney General's Office from the state of Iowa, along with the District of Columbia, they reached out and they found that over 90% of all transactions at crypto kiosks in their state were fraudulent. That's a very compelling number when you find like over 90% of these transactions are tied to fraud. We also saw that the FBI reported that they had 11,000 complaints about cryptocurrency kiosks specifically last year, which is a 99% increase. And they also reported there's $9.3 billion lost to this cryptocurrency. So, you know, our messaging here isn't that, you know, all cryptocurrency is bad. It's the method in which it's how it's being used, because it certainly can be an investment. A lot of people made money, and that's fine. But what we want to recognize is when something's demanding or requiring you to pay for it, and if they're absolutely telling you to go to one of these kiosks, please tell, it's a scam. If anyone is directing you to put cash in one of these kiosks, it's absolutely a scam. So if there's anything that I would just drive home, the point is that, and then also taking an opportunity to share that information with friends and family. Because, you know, we may hear this right now, but the more we can spread the word and bring awareness that if anyone's directing you there to stop and talk to someone, hopefully we can try and put a dent in the number of victims that we're seeing.
You wonder, I mean, if it's 9 out of 10 times, from the sound of it, you're going to one of these places, you're going to be... Why isn't there any regulation on this? People wonder, I'm sure.
So our Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions has issued guidance to the vendors of all these that says you need to display some disclosures, you need to put some warnings up, trying to limit the amount of each transaction that can take place. And they're putting the guidance and hoping that through. But there also have been discussions both at the state and federal level on what would that regulation look like. And, you know, nothing has been enacted, but... because of what we're seeing with this data and how they are being misused, we're hoping we can shore that up a little bit.
Let's take a call from Rosanna in Madison. Rosanna, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I get a lot of emails from businesses, companies trying to sell me something or maybe even just give me a recipe, and I always would say unsubscribe, but someone told me by clicking on that they can get my information. Is that true?
Yes, that is true and can be true, and it's difficult if it's a scammer that's behind it. You're clicking a link, and we don't know what they've put behind all those links. There could be malware that's loaded onto your device and things. So if it's something you're completely unfamiliar with and have never engaged in doing business, it's come out of the blue or maybe an affiliate of a company you've worked with, just put them to junk, you know, delete them. Try and set a rule that will automatically put them to junk set them, you know, to be caught by your spam filter type situation versus the unsubscribe there. You can use unsubscribe when you have engaged with a company, purchased something, you said you want to get future ads, and now, you know, you're not into that, that thing anymore, that art, that craft, whatever it is, and then you unsubscribe, and usually you'll see that those diminish and maybe one pops up around the holidays again, but those are honored. When you're trying to unsubscribe to these others that are coming out of the blue, you see they keep coming, and that is also a sign that you just need to set that filter.
Rosanna, thank you for calling. Darlene in Mount Horeb, we'll go to you next. Hi, Darlene.
Hi, good afternoon. First of all, I apologize if you've already talked about this, but I turned the program on a little bit too late. But, you know, we've always been very careful about giving out our cell phone number, and cause we still have a landline. But we've been getting a lot of texts lately. We just got one last night thanking us for a purchase. Last night it was a $5,000 purchase from Amazon, and, you know, we obviously did not do that. And a couple weeks ago, it was another one from, I don't remember if they even gave us the name of the company, or they certainly didn't tell us what we bought, but it was for $424. And, you know, the address where it's coming from, obviously, it just looks like a bunch of junk, so we figure it's a scam. But is there some way we can prevent those types of texts from coming?
Michael, do you want to...
Well, there are some programs within the software that your phone is using that will prevent some of those coming through. Some of them won't. One feature that I would encourage you to use if you do receive the message is delete it and report it as junk because one, it'll get rid of it, but it'll also identify with the carrier that that is potentially a scam, and it'll hopefully prevent some of those messages from getting through to you. The ability to just outright stop all of them from coming will be very difficult. With our cell numbers, we're providing that information for legitimate purposes when we make purchases or we have to go to a health appointment. And sometimes that information just gets out there. And so that phone number will circulate through. So I'm not aware of any way that you'll ever be able to stop all of them, but it's really more about what your behavior is once you receive them. And that is making sure that you don't respond to them.
Yeah. And clicking junk.
Correct. Clicking that, you know, almost all of the software apps now, the software providers for our cell phones give you the opportunity to delete it and report it as junk. And that will reduce the messages from that particular number from coming through again.
Darlene, thanks again for calling. Micah emailed to say that checking with Charity Navigator online is a good way to determine that a charity is legit. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Give.org, CharityNavigator.org, both great resources to do your research about charities. You can also check with the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions to see that a charity is registered to make solicitations and receive donations in the state of Wisconsin. So you can go to that state agency as well. So all great resources.
Michael, to add?
And one thing I'll also add that I really love about those websites is we always encourage everyone to keep giving, but they do a little bit more of a deeper dive and let you know where that money's going. And so a little help breakdown, not just that the organization is legitimate, but it helps you know what portion of your donation is going to go to overhead, what will go to the cause, and helps you know a little bit more and have a little bit more confidence when you do give.
Greta emailed with something I have you comment on. There are consumer protection lawyers, Greta says, who can help people defraud by timeshare sellers, car dealers, and lending agencies. These attorneys only collect fees once the wrong party has recovered their losses. So that seems like a low risk for consumers.
Yeah, that is available. Consumer Protection is here to receive complaints and mediate them, and we track them across the state so we can find those trends and take enforcement action against businesses who are not following the state's consumer protection laws. The lawyers are there for those individual private actions and private rights. So certainly a consumer can start with us and file their complaint, make us aware. But once a consumer has started a private action, we won't be able to assist with the mediation on their behalf because the lawyer will be involved and it's potential that the courts will have made a decision. However, their information can still be used as part of any case if we develop it. So it is really important that you do still file a complaint with Consumer Protection so we have that full awareness.
And so it kind of reminds me in a way of some of the scams that involve, and I think you talked about them earlier, Michael, where there are companies that will provide a service. I'm not saying that for the attorneys here, but for companies that will provide services that you could do yourself.
Correct. You know, to your point, a lot of these attorneys, and oftentimes, I shouldn't say often, there are times in which, you know, we will mediate and reach a point where we say, unfortunately, you might just have to reach out to an attorney for this, or their particular issue will require an attorney that we're not able to help with. But in large, we're saying there might be, if we have the chance to reach out on your behalf and see if we can reach a resolution before contacting that attorney, it helps you be more informed on what is going on. It gives you a little bit more information on what that business might have done or what the reasoning was. And then if you do have to contact an attorney, you have a little bit more to provide to them. And so it gives them a more fast track to help.
And Jack had emailed to ask once again to repeat your website address and phone number to reach the consumer protection team. That's good advice.
That website is datcp.wy.gov, or you can call us at 1-800-422-7128.
422-7128. Yeah, there we go. And we'll probably have that up. Joel's probably going to put that up on our today's program date within the comments at talk@wpr.org/Larry. We can post those numbers as well. There was another thing that I wanted to bring up. Amazon refunds. Real refunds are being paid to Amazon Prime customers. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. So in September, Amazon agreed to pay $2.5 billion to settle a Federal Trade Commission's charges that it had enrolled millions of individuals in Prime subscriptions without consent, and then that they made it difficult for those Prime subscribers to actually cancel their plans. So of that total $2.5 billion, $1.5 billion is being returned to consumers. And we want to make sure that they do know how they're going to be receiving it and who's eligible, so no one has the potential of falling victim to a scammer out there trying to take advantage of this situation. So consumers could be eligible for a refund of up to $51 okay. if they are based in the United States and they used less than 3 of the Prime benefits in any 12-month period after enrolling in Prime. And then that they began their Prime membership through either a specific enrollment workflow or unsuccessfully tried to cancel their Prime membership between January 23rd of 2019 and January 23rd of this year. So a 6-year period where you'd have to have qualified in that way. These refunds are going to be automatically sent by Amazon by December 25th, Christmas. So there is no form that you need to fill out, no phone call you need to answer to give over information or your password or nothing you need to verify and click a link. You can get these details at ftc.gov/Amazon. So go to the Federal Trade Commission's website, ftc.gov/Amazon, and you can find out all those details again.
Ben emailed to ask, how secure is ID.me? I don't know ID.me.
So ID.me is a service that's used oftentimes to validate if somebody had military service. They'll also, I don't know if they've branched out into first responders in the medical community, but I'm familiar with that side of it. I don't know how secure it is. I would be remiss to guarantee that any website is 100% secure, because we've seen a lot of both government agencies and, you know, regular businesses unfortunately suffer data breaches. So I think every website is potentially at risk of being breached, but I don't know that I would be able to say that particular one is more or less.
Jory in Madison will go to you now. Hi, Jory.
Hi, Larry. A few weeks ago, we received like 3 pair of socks in the mail, unsolicited. They were addressed to my wife's first name and my last name, which is our last names are not the same. And there was indication of where it came from, but not why. We didn't order these socks. I didn't engage with it at all. But I'm wondering, how is this a scam, and how does this benefit somebody to just send out product unsolicited?
So this is a scam called brushing, and there's a couple of different reasons that these businesses will do it. One is they'll send this product out, and they'll get a list of consumer information with the names and addresses, and then they'll send the product out. And what that does is it often will increase their sales and give them an opportunity also. So let's just say they're using an online marketer like Amazon. And so then by sending these out, they have those confirmed what they look like sales by that product being delivered. But then what they'll also do is they'll follow up on what appeared to be a purchase and leave a review. So then on that particular platform, it looks like they have, you know, 5,000 purchases, and then they have 4,000 great reviews. And then if that third-party marketing platform were to review those sales and those transactions, it looks legitimate. So that company is essentially kind of eating that cost of the product getting sent out at first, but the return on investment by them showing to be a great seller and having great reviews is why they're going to get that return.
And then they enhanced this scam a few years later, when we first saw it come about, to include a QR code on the outside of this package. So people would then question and click this QR code, which you'd go there and they'd ask for your personal information in order to try and find out more about the details in the sender that you were doing a verification and things. So If you get an unexpected package, you can return to sender. You can choose to keep it. But we want you to be sure that you're doing a digital footprint look to see how your name may be used out in the online world, in that it could be used in for reviews and things. So you do want to kind of check and track that if you should be so lucky to receive one of these brushing packages. It's nice it's socks during this cold spell.
Well, I got a pair of socks in the mail. I, you know, oh, what's this? I open up and and then I knew right away what it was, because it was WPR socks.
Oh.
And I had donated during our member drive enough so that I got a pair of socks.
Nice.
Out of it. So,
go with your baseball cap.
Go with my baseball cap and about 20 shirts that are WPR shirts. Oh my goodness. One other one that comes up a lot, and that has to do with timeshares. That I just want to – people who bought a timeshare might regret it. But you hear a lot of ads relating to from companies that say, "We'll get you out of your timeshare," and how legitimate are these?
Well, some of them are legitimate. Some of them we know that are in partnership with the companies that are also selling them, and there's an opportunity to help that consumer on both ends of that. But then some of them are scammers, and they're looking to take advantage of those sellers. And so what they're going to, some of the things that you look for as kind of a red flag is if they're telling you, hey, you need to pay up front for any of our services and you really can't do anything until you pay us or provide us some information, that's going to cause you pause. What they oftentimes will associate that to say, well, if you pay us up front, you're going to get your money on the back end when we sell it. And so you'll get that refunded and, you know, they're going to convince you that you're really not going to be owed anything. We're also going to have what you'll see is once you pay that, they're going to come up with these excuses to why there hasn't been any traction, why there hasn't been any action, why it hasn't been sold. You haven't seen any paperwork being submitted. And they have these all excuses as to why it's going to take longer and longer. And by creating that delay, it gives them opportunity to say, we need more money. We need money for additional fees. The company that's being sold to is requiring fees. We had to get new lawyers involved because it's in a different state or maybe it's international. So all of these things are kind of those that would encompass the entire scam and how they keep trying to get more money out of you. A few things you can do if you are in the market for selling that is first is search the company that is purporting to sell it for you and just attach the word scam or complaint or review. And we know that if something goes wrong in today's day and age, it doesn't take them too much to jump online and tell somebody about it. So those scams will show up for you. Ask them about those fees. Ask, are you going to have to pay up front or afterwards? If it's up front, that's going to be a problem. And then make sure you get everything in writing. And that is so that if it does go sideways, you have an opportunity to reach out to us and give us a chance to help. But really, it helps to have all those promises, agreements, and contracts in writing so that we know what we're going to be asking about.
Man. On that note, boy, we covered a lot today on the show. Unfortunately, there's there's a need for your job, your positions in consumer protection. But I want to thank you so much for always coming by and being happy to talk with us, Michael and Michelle. Thank you both.
Well, thank you, Larry. We really appreciate the opportunity to get the word out there and try and help and keep people safe.
Michelle Reinen is administrator of DATCAP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael Domke is the director of DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. It's always great to have them come by. Up next, we talk to Wisconsin author Patricia Skalka about her new, really nice, great new novella. It's titled Star Song, and you can join the conversation coming up at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Beethoven's Ode to Joy. And we're starting with that because that particular piece by Beethoven plays a critical role in the new novella titled Star Song, written by our guest with us now, Patricia Skalka. I really enjoyed reading this novella. You know, here's Patricia, who is, many listeners may know her from her Dave Kubiak Door County Mystery series. And this new work of fiction is, I think, a departure, at least from her previous writing. We'll explore the new themes and characters in it. And I hope you'll join in the conversation. Have you read Patricia's work? Do you wonder how tragedy affects children and maybe their understanding of mortality? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Patricia Skalka, it's great to have you back. Welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. It's delightful to be here. Always nice to talk to you.
Yeah, this new book is so different. Star Song is the title again. It's about a young girl and her family. What was the inspiration for the story?
It actually came, the story grew out of a question that both my daughters asked me when they were 10, which is the age of the child in the book. And they and this happened 4 years apart. So they were reading for a school assignment a book called Tuck Everlasting, which is about a family that discovers a magic stream or spring that if you drink from it, you live forever. And the question was, what happens when you die? So my older daughter asked me this question. We had this conversation that basically appears in the book. And then 4 years later, her younger sister asks me the exact same question. She's reading the same book. We have the same conversation. So it's like my kids gave me this idea of okay, you know, investigate this. And when you're a writer, it's like, well, what if and what if and what if? So I took their question and curiosity and just went with it and just came up with this idea for this book.
Well, it's a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading it. But as you're talking about it here, I see this as a book of people of that age range would also very much enjoy it. Maybe that's where who you intended it for or not?
No, I actually wrote it. Now, the narrator, it's written in the first person. So Georgia, who is 10 at the time that this happens, is now many, many decades later. So she's looking back on her life and talking about what happened the year that she turned 10, that fall. And it's really, I mean, I wrote it as a book for adults. I mean, she doesn't, you know, she's not talking as a child telling the story. She's talking as an adult looking back on what happened to her and her family that year. I think it would work for young adults. Young adults could certainly read it, but it's not a children's book as such. No. It's really for older readers.
Yeah, but I think children, you know, of an age, a certain age, would really enjoy and get a lot out of it as well.
Well, I agree. It's not a children's book in the sense of a picture book, you know,
for little kids.
But for older children, yes.
Yeah, this is a novella. It's a departure from your other writings, certainly. How did you know you wanted to tell this story in a shorter form?
Well, you know, stories somehow have personalities of their own. You know, they either fit one way or they fit another way. And I did have an agent who said to me, well, if you can turn this into a full-length novel, you know, I'll be able to sell it. And I tried doing that, and it didn't work. It just didn't feel right. You know, you have this gut feeling that you have to go with. It's just like I wrote it originally in the third person, which is the way I would normally write.
Yeah.
And that was okay. And then I read some things that were done in the first person, and I thought, I had this inspiration to say, well, maybe that's what I should do with this and make it the story being told, you know, from the perspective of Georgia, who is now the last person who remembers, the last person who was there that fateful night. And so now she wants to share this and pass it along. So it just kind of changed the whole focus of the way the story was told. And, you know, sometimes you just have to go with these things.
Yeah, well, I think you did the right thing. I really
Thank you.
It, you know, and it's, I'm glad it's coming out, you know, around now, because I think it's a great holiday, maybe a great Christmas book. I don't think you intend it as a Christmas story, and but it is kind of, isn't it? Or maybe did you ever see it that way?
No, I didn't intend it as a Christmas story, but I needed it to end on a memorable occasion. So I kind of went back and forth. Well, it does end on Christmas Eve. So in that respect, it is a great Christmas story, but it's also a story that could be read any time of the year. I thought at one point of having it end on the mother's birthday or on Mother's Day or something like that. But somehow, you know, especially with the Ode to Joy, it just really, again, you go with what seems to be right, and it seemed to just speak to me that it needed to end on that day.
Yeah. Well, here we have the well, maybe you could just talk about, in general, about the book and what's going on in the book.
Well, what happens is that you have a family that seems to be really ideal. They only have one kind of difference between the parenting. You know, the mother is a believer, and she's also a pediatric surgeon. The father, who is a professor, is a non-believer. And so the child kind of grows up going back and forth, not quite knowing, you know, what to believe, what not to believe. And this all culminates, you know, then her mother dies. And it's a coming of age of learning to deal with loss and grief and learning to deal with her father. But there's more to it, because it's one of the things that her mother promised her was that if she, you know, the child said, when you die, would you try to contact me? And her mother said, yes. And so that's what led to the, well, okay, if that happens, you don't have a story. You just have an anecdote of something, you know, that this happened. So I needed something where there would be a challenge and a drama and a problem and an issue. And what I kept thinking of was this idea of, you know, no greater love has someone than they give up their life for another. And I thought, well, what if there is a greater love? How would it express itself? So the story really pivots around, what if a mother's love is so deep that she gives up something more precious than her life to save her child? Because, of course, something does happen to Georgia along the way. And that became the focus of the story. So what does happen, and how do you respond to it, and how does a child like Georgia respond to it, and how does her father respond to her response? And so you have conflict and you have resolution, which makes for movement and action in a story.
You know, after I finished reading the book, I thought about it, the novella, I thought about it a lot. And one of the things that really struck me was you have three parts, sort of. You have the first part is called love, the second part is called loss, and the third part is titled light. And what you did to me, and probably will happen to a lot of other people, is in your first section, love, you finish that section and you love that family. Despite their differences, and you care about them. And I thought to myself, you did in 27 pages. You had me really rooting, and you were creating an ideal family situation, even though there are some differences between belief in God or whatnot. The type of family almost anyone would be happy to be a part of. And so when something happens, you're forced really to read on and to feel the loss more deeply, I think. How much time did you spend on that first section?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because I probably wrote it and rewrote it many times, you know, which is what you do if you're writing, whether it's a novella, a short story, or a novel. I mean, the writing of the first draft is one thing, but it's in the editing that you really kind of finesse it. And I just put my, you know, it's like putting yourself into that situation. And I, when I rewrote it in the first person, I was able to do that, I think, much more so than, you know, you mentioned the Kubiak stories. Okay, the Kubiak stories are mysteries, but they're murder mysteries. This is a mystery about life and death. And it's a mystery we all think about. We don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't understand. And so that's really elemental to the whole story. And what does it mean to a 10-year-old child? You know, she talks about how it changed her, that she was different. She was a child of loss and how it affected her. This is something that people go through when they lose a loved one.
And the power of music certainly comes into play. And we've got, there are maybe seven major characters in the book, somewhere about that, I believe. So there's Georgia, there's Harry, her father, and Dr. Sherry Weldon, her mother, is a pediatric surgeon. And Toby is Georgia's best friend. And they play the violin in their school orchestra, and their music teacher is Ludwig Meyer. Describe him for us.
Well, he's an old crotchety guy who had a great reputation as a teacher and a professor of music, who got pushed out of his job at the local college and went to the elementary school, terrified the kids, you know, because here's this, like, bent over man who kind of, you know, he's got, they can't relate to him. He wears different colored socks. They think he's like really weird, but he loves the children and he loves music, and he convinces them that yes, they can do this. They can play what they, you know, if you play from the heart, he says, play from the heart and all the world will listen. All the universe will listen, which is very important. And he convinces them that they can, and music transcends everything. He convinces them that they can transcend what they think they can do. And so they're in this state competition and they're playing, you know, a simplified version, a children's version of the Ode to Joy. And they are the youngest orchestra. And do they win or not? I mean, that's part of the story too. And it's just, he also is the one who identified or characterized the Ode to Joy as the world's greatest prayer, which of course becomes really critical to the story then when, after the mom dies and when Georgia is trying to figure out a way to help her mother because something has happened to her mom even after death.
And so, and that was the first piece of music they learned to play as an orchestra. It was interesting to me that Joel Patnaud, our producer, said when he was in middle school, Ode to Joy was the first piece of music that they learned as an orchestra. And he could hear the simplified introductory version for young musicians as you were describing it. He was hearing it. And Jill laughed out loud and said, me too. That was my...
yeah, and one of the things that I thought of, you know, I chose that because I love that piece of music because people can identify with it. And when you watch all these YouTube videos of pop-up concerts and they do the Ode to Joy and, you know, the camera pans the people who are listening, look at their faces. They are just taken to another place and they're all smiling and happy. It doesn't matter if they're children or adults. And I recently had the privilege of attending the Milwaukee Symphony. They performed Beethoven's Ninth. And when they did the Ode to Joy, you had a sense of everyone in that room, in that orchestra hall, we were all like connected. We were all transported beyond ourselves by this music. So music has that power. And that's why it's so important to this story.
Our guest today, Patricia Skalka, her latest novella, her latest book is a novella, and it is titled Star Song. Great to have her with us. And I'd love to hear from you. If you have a comment or a thought, you can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. Was that the first piece that you learned when you were 10 years old in an orchestra? Ode to Joy. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. talking about the novella Star Song with its author, Patricia Skalka. And again, join in with your own thoughts as we move along. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. Here's a character in your book, Dr. Sherry Weldon, George's mother, scientific in life and kind of mystical in death. And how does her passing change everything for Georgia and her father?
Well,
and you talked a little about from Georgia's perspective, but.
Yeah, Georgia talks about how life became meaningless. The world became empty. Her life became empty. And it was like, why should I do anything? Why should I go to school? Why should I do my homework? Why should I? She was lost. You know, she was a lost soul without her mom. And it was music that kind of pulled her back. But there's also the change with her, the conflict with her father, because she had, you know, she was grasping to hold on to her mom. And her father had the idea that we'll never be normal again. And we have to change everything. You know, everything's changed. We're going to be different. And there was this conflict in how they dealt with the loss, because his way of dealing with it was move the clothes out, get rid of the pictures, take her books off the shelf, to not remind, you know, people have this idea that if you don't remind anyone about the person they've lost, that's going to be easier. When in fact, I mean, he meant well, but it was exactly the wrong thing to do. So you have the conflict between father and daughter, who'd always been very close. And yet now they're struggling to even know how to connect with each other, because they have this very, very different way of grieving.
It puts Georgia in a very tough situation. And her father doesn't respond well in other ways, too. He starts to drink or drink more, and that creates a few issues. But she becomes a little obsessed with getting a message from her mother. It's kind of an obsession, I would think.
Well, it is an obsession, but in real life, her mother always had a way of sending a message. You know, when there's a scene at the beginning where she does the show and tell at school, and when she gets in her car, she flashes her headlights twice. That was like her signal, love you, the two words. So she would always like knock twice, love you. You know, and so, you know, it's very important that to Georgia that she, I don't know how much of the plot to give away.
Yeah,
that's, say what happens.
Yeah, I know.
It's kind of tricky, but she needs to get this message that her mother is okay because of everything that happens to both Georgia and then the mom. I will just say one thing that maybe is important for anyone to understand. What her mother learns after death is that you are given one chance to come back, one chance only, where you can return to your place of origin, whether it's the Earth or another planet, and spend that day. And she chooses the day of the orchestra performance to return to Earth. So Georgia feels a spiritual sense when she's on the stage. So she has a sense of her mother being with her. And then, of course, there's more tragedy that ensues after that, which leads to the whole rest of the story.
Loma in Viroqua emailed to ask you if, Patricia, when you begin to write, is the story pretty much fully formed in your mind, or does it and just needs to be put into words, or you discover what happens as you're writing it?
You know, there are two approaches, and one approach is to just start and go with it. And that's not the approach that works for me. I need to think the story through and know the beginning, the middle, the end. And, you know, obviously there's still a lot to fill in, but I know what the story is before I start to write it. And that means that I can focus on the writing. I don't have to constantly keep wondering what's going to happen next, because I know.
That makes pretty good sense. But the writing itself, I mean, there are scenes in that third act, the scene. And I think of this, by the way, as I thought this would make a wonderful play. And I was trying to envision how it could work given some of the circumstances I don't want to talk too much about to give the whole book away. But I think it could work really well as a play and probably as a movie.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. I think it would. It has all the right elements in it.
I really do think that. What does the story say about the immeasurable love between a mother and a daughter?
I think you use the right word. It's immeasurable. A mother will do anything for her child. And, you know, at one point, Sherry does say that. You're my daughter. How could I not do this? How could I not make this sacrifice for you? There's just no question that I would do this. And I think that's what any parent would do. But especially, I think there's a connection between mother and daughter that is just that deep.
And what do you hope readers are going to take away from Star's Song? There's a lot, I think, that could be taken from this. But what do you hope?
Again, you keep using the magic word. I hope that they take a sense of hope. That this, although it's a tragic story in a sense, it ends on a note of hope and a note of kind of the value and beauty of life and all that it entails. And that you have to have faith in yourself, that you have faith in what you know is the right thing to do and the path you have to follow. So the Georgia at 10 years old knew what she had to do. And even though it was hard for her, she did it. And it's just it gives you a positive feeling that maybe all things are possible.
Yeah. I was thinking about Ode to Joy and remembering the words. And I couldn't quite remember the opening words, but I looked them up, actually, because I couldn't remember them exactly. And the first words are, O friends, no more of these sounds. Let us sing more joyful songs, more full of joy. And those are the opening. And it continues then. The words themselves continue with the themes of universal brotherhood, of the joy you find in friends and family members, the love, the joy of love, the joy of maybe nature as well. Those are the kinds of themes that you see in the words to Ode to Joy. And I'm thinking about that in relation to your book, and I think those are some of the same themes that you're expressing in this lovely book.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I think so. And even to the extent that, you know, George's father is very scientifically oriented, but at one point he says, where did you get this idea? And she says, from you. Because you talked about, you know, our relation to the cosmos, and he's just stunned by this, that she has used what he told her to plot out this plan that she then follows.
I love the Dave Kubiak series, and I see John wants to know if you're ever going to bring that back. I guess you could do it, but it was a fitting end, that last book. But what do you think?
Well, it was a fitting end, but I'm working on book 8. There is another Kubiak, because I got yet another idea that took it even a little bit further. So there will be another Kubiak.
Oh, and that's what you're working on now, I presume, or you're probably working now on promoting the book a little bit.
Both things. You know, it's like on the one hand, I'm working on promoting Star Song, but I'm also working on writing the next Kubiak, which is Death Sets a Trap.
Well, you'll be back to talk about that with us, I hope, whenever.
I hope so.
and the book, the response you're getting from the readers?
Very positive. People are very moved by it. I've had people who've already told me that they've read it twice because they were so moved by it.
Yeah, I would agree with those folks as well. Thank you very much, Patricia, for writing this novella and for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, and thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
The book is Star Song, a novella, the author Patricia Skalka. It's wonderful to have her on. It's kind of wonderful to hear that music in the background as well as we move along. And wonderful to have a great group of people with me here. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you so much for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.